Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 40, titled The Evolutionary Course of Beauty.
The reason I translated it as creativity in that context is that it is hard to find a word for effort. Many words have been tried: vigor, courage, enthusiasm, industry, enterprise, initiative. You know, people have tried all those words. And among them, no one ever tried creativity. And among them, some words for making an effort that have to do with only in the good, only in positive things. Because in the way the Buddhists define the word virya, it is effort that is aimed at the good, you know, dharma, in that dharmic effort, let's call it. And so creativity, I thought, you can be a creative bank robber or murderer, of course. So none of them exclude making an effort to do something negative. But on the other hand, creativity we pretty much associate with something good and great and beautiful, you know. So I thought that was a good thing. And its opposite is laziness. And but particularly, again, laziness in doing something creative in terms of a positive thing, you know. So I translate it as creativity. And I also want to translate, it relates to the concept of art and the concept of, you know, making a better world and making a better self, and all of those evolving in a positive direction. And so that is that branch of the Eightfold Path, I think. You know, if it comes as the sixth branch, and, you know, by that time you have your realistic worldview. Just to recapitulate where it fits. You have your realistic worldview. You have your realistic motivation of how to use your life in such a way as to be in tune with reality. You know, the realistic worldview is pure realism. Basically, that's one of my slogans, that I think one of my special ideas, that Buddhism is fundamentally realism. Because of Buddha's discovery that reality is nirvana, freedom from suffering, reality is bliss, as he would later put it in Tantra. And so then you have your realistic motivation, which is to seek that and to use your life to evolve towards awareness of that at all times, Buddhahood, in other words. And then once you have that, you have to stabilize your relationships with others in the world, because contrary to people's wrong stereotypes of Buddhism, that nirvanic reality is not some place outside the world, some place out, you know, beyond, just a vast empty space of some kind. It is the world itself, realistically understood. And so therefore, relativity is really, nirvana is relativity. And Buddha is the discoverer of that, you know. Reached by the critical concept of emptiness. I mean, I'm just recapitulating earlier things to set the setting of this chapter, of this breakthrough idea, I think, of mine, since that's what we're after in this short work. And then you do your ethical things, and you have realistic terminal action, in the sense of action that is meant to create this realistic world of goodness for all beings. You have realistic speech, which is, of course, speech is always a way of interacting with others, even when you're internally just thinking. And you have realistic livelihood. where you don't want to have a way of living that harms other people and that causes more turbulence, actually, in your world. Because if you make more turbulence, then you will not have the peace to develop your mind, to educate yourself, and so on, and to evolve. And you'll be in constant conflict and struggle with others if you are harmful toward them. And so those three things are where you get your ethics together, your goodness together, let's say. You know, first is truth, and then next is goodness. And then, if you go to what are called the three transcendentals in Western philosophy, you know, the true, the good, and the beautiful, the truth, goodness, and beauty. And so then you get to truth. You know, so truth is the realistic worldview, and then the ethical is the realistic motivation, evolutionary action, speech, and livelihood. And now you're getting toward the beautiful, which is you're beginning to expand to encounter the actual experience of this world that you have figured out is there, realistically, and now you want to fully experience it. So the first thing you do is creativity. And although in a way creativity goes for everything, for discovering the truth, for being good, and finally for the seventh and eighth branches, which we will deal with later, which are mindfulness. Well, we already dealt with the seventh in a way, mindfulness, and understanding your psychology, and as part of a key part of your evolution. And finally, samadhi, which is where you insist on experiencing what is real. You get rid of all distraction from your focus on what is real. You become one-pointed. You seek unity with what is real. And that's really what samadhi is. So with the creativity is this broad, general one. It could have been the first one in a way, but it would be useless to put it first when the first thing is to develop, to commit yourself to getting out of being stuck in an unrealistic, ignorance-dominated world. Okay? So there we are in creativity, and there we are philosophically in the realm of aesthetics. And here there's a wonderful thing about the Sanskrit language, why India is such an advanced culture. In India, there are a number of words. The words for goodness are kalyana. And kalyana means just very much good, and actually is cognate with the Greek kalon, kalo, which means good. When you say, how are you? You say, kalo. I'm good. And they ask, how was that? You say, good. You say, kalo. Kalon is their word for good. And kalyana is the word for good in Sanskrit. Then in an evolutionary karmic context, the word used for good, or which is translated as good action and bad action, is the word kushala. But as we have discussed, I think previously, in that context, kushala really means skill. And it only makes sense as good when you're thinking in terms of evolution. So therefore, anything that evolves you toward the highest state, the summum bonum, the highest good, which is Buddhahood, is skillful and therefore automatically good. But even in Tibetan, which was a culture that had much less richness than India at first, before it adopted all these concepts from India, that word for skill was not maintained as skill, but they translated it with the same word they translate for kalyana, which is good. So good extended over two sets of concepts instead of using the word skill. And the Tibetans, gewa, in the context of Tibetans, they translated as gewa, both, which mean virtue. And similarly, a third word in Sanskrit, which is shubha, which is related to a verb root that uses the word sh, which means to shine, like somehow Anglo-Saxon shine is in that ballpark. And so shining, or actually shobhanam, means to beautiful. So shubha, not shubha, so when you do something skillful, which is a good, skillful, which is kushala, which is a kalyana thing, which is good, it also is a beautiful thing, which is shubha. So that's really interesting that you have three aspects, the true, the good, and the beautiful, or rather the good and the skillful, if you will, and the beautiful are a set of three different things. But those three things are all translated by the Tibetans as virtuous. And this is also the case in English, where they're more or less translated as virtuous. You know, like, for example, we say sometimes, when somebody does or says something great, we'll say brilliant in modern slang, or we'll say beautiful, you know, I just succeeded in something, or, you know, here's a great present, you know, some virtuous deed, some nice thing of making a generous thing, and you say, oh, beautiful, beautiful. We don't always say good, good about everything. They are sort of seeing, coming toward the true, the good, and the beautiful from a sort of aesthetic side. We want to say something about beauty. So that's really interesting. And, of course, we think of virtue as beautiful, and we think of it as brilliant and shining, and we associate the good with light and so forth, and brightness, you know. And I think in our translations of Buddhist Sanskrit texts, we should follow that, and we should... we should follow that, and we should develop different words, and we should really bring beauty into connection with virtue and goodness, and we should bring skill into connection with virtue and goodness, and not just everything is virtue, virtue, which people just sort of think of as being good. And in our authoritarian culture, goodness is too much associated with rule following and obedience. You know, good boy, you know, we say to the dog, good, good, you know. And we think of following rules because, you know, in our monotheistic based, long-developed culture and language, goodness is considered just rule following, you know, rather than conforming to reality, being realistic, reaching for reality, realizing that what is beautiful is reality, and reality is what is beautiful, rather. You know, things are beautiful insofar as they are attuned to reality. And this is really important. For example, in our last dialogue about karma, where we were talking about skill and so on, and we mentioned just in terms of the paramitas, or the transcendences, that what I prefer, transcendences rather than perfection, as they are more or less settled, had been settled until recently. The ethical, the interactive transcendences, which are generosity, morality, or justice, and tolerance, or patience. Generosity is the source of wealth, as I said, you know, in evolutionary terms. So being generous is skillful in the sense of it leads to the attainment of wealth. And being moral is skillful in that it leads to the attainment of humanity, which is defined really as among life forms, altruistic. It's the more altruistic life form, basically, which of course doesn't mean that individual humans are always altruistic, but and therefore, a human who conceives the spirit of enlightenment or develops the awakening mind, depending on how we decide to translate that, or the awakening, the spirit of awakening, that one is being skillful in their developing the next step beyond ordinary humanity toward heightening the altruism of ordinary humanity, something you can say like that. And then beauty is developed from tolerance or patience, meaning the ability to absorb injury from others without anger and still being pleasant and being accepting and being altruistic about the other, seeing it from the other's point of view, understanding the harmer rather than just reacting to destroy the harmer. This is the evolutionary cause of beauty, and therefore being tolerant of injury is itself skillful and leads to beauty, which is a quality we all think of as something good, property of good, something good. So that's really interesting, you know. And therefore, creativity, the creative energy. Oh, energy is another translation actually I have used in the past about virya, you know, a high energy person or being energetic as opposed to being slothful. So anyway, I'm not saying that creativity is the ultimate translation for virya. Finally, effort can be all right. You can say creative effort. You can say energetic effort. You know, effort is fundamentally the opposite of laziness, I guess. I mean, who knows how this will settle down in half a century from now. But I think creativity is an important part of it. Anyway, also, creativity is, as the sixth branch of the Eightfold Path, is, of course, essential to getting anything done. And particularly where you're doing something out of the ordinary. You're not just following some social habit of the time. And in Buddha's time, he wants people to create a new social mode. He's actually starting a social revolution. He's starting a psychological revolution, a scientific revolution, an ethical revolution. He's starting all kinds of revolutions. So for that, creativity is required. And, of course, if you say that, therefore, the initial creativity is, okay, why should I slave away at wage slavery? Why should I, you know, have a family to create more population in the world? Why should I farm more just to feed more people? There's a surplus of food. There's a surplus of people. There are other people who like doing that. I have come to see the purpose of life as something different. So I'm going to just do none of these ordinary subsistence things, but I am going to seek the higher meaning of reality of my human life. And I'm doing that not only for my sake, but for others' sake, because then I can help them also realize the aim of their human life. And I think even the monk, the mendicant, male or female, you know, monk or nun or mendicant, a male or female mendicant, they are doing that not only because they're seeking to escape from suffering, or because they don't want to work, or they don't want to fight in the army, or they don't want to bear children or whatever, although all of those may be part of the reason, but because they see a better possibility of a better world. That's what calls them. And after all, we can internalize the values of a society, of productivity, you know, conformity, and all of these things. The feedback, we get feedback from a childhood about that. And so people like to work, and people like to, you know, do things, and they like sex, and they like, and the, you know, even the labor, the very hard work of bearing a child of a female has its hormonal and endorphin level rewards. And then, of course, the child grows up to help you, ideally, in an agricultural society, to grow your food when you're old and so on. So, I mean, it's not like samsara does have the suffering of change, which is a kind of relative happiness. And it could be even that relative happiness has a dimension in it that is like a touching of the generous and the beautiful and the true and the oneness of reality. Actually, you know, there's a way of redeeming even samsara when you see it from a Buddha's point of view. So that's a social creativity to become a mendicant and to drop out and to develop what Castaneda called warrior's abandon. That is a social creativity. And then a psychological creativity is to recognize that altruism is the most skillful element that brought you to your humanity, and therefore that if you change your motivation in seeking skillfully your higher evolutionary being, that motivation of unselfishness and altruism is the one that actually makes you happy right away. It actually empowers whatever practice you do. You know, they say that a practice is Theravada, or, you know, Hinayana, what the Mahayanas would call Hinayana, if its motive is more for self than for other. A practice is Mahayana when the motivation is for others. So you can do the same. You could do something like meditate on ugliness. You know, you could meditate the Mindubha Gompa, the Ashubha, the ugliness meditation, you know, like a rotted and bloating corpse and, you know, skeletons, all this kind of thing, which people do to get rid of surface lust and, you know, being gripped by craving and desire and the frustration of not having what you desire. And one therefore meditates on ugliness and the unpleasantness of things. And you can do that in a weaker way when it says, oh, then I'm going to be cool where I won't want anything. I won't be horny or something. You can do that. Or you can do that. You can say, I'm going to get this greater freedom from my basic drive for greed and craving and frustration about that. And I'm going to develop greater freedom from that in order to help other beings. So I'll be someone who won't be competing with them in greedy fights and conflicts and competitions. And that will make your meditation on Ashubha, on ugliness, which is a very important one in Theravada Buddhism, but also for bodhisattvas, and makes it much more powerful. It makes it a bodhisattva practice. And that is why it is said that when one first enters the order, the Buddha order, you know, when one gets a glimpse of a higher reality that would inspire one, then and meets a Buddha or someone in the direction of a Buddha, and therefore has that inspiration, that the sooner one makes the bodhisattva vow, the better. And the really the only prerequisite for the bodhisattva vow, in a way, is the common sense reality that one has an infinite future in any case, and that one has that infinite future interrelated with other beings. And therefore, once one is going to be forever interrelated with other beings, it becomes commonsensical and not just some sort of wild leap of insane altruism, but commonsensical that one wants to maximize or optimize one's relationships with other beings. So therefore, one wants to love them as much as possible, and if possible, have them love one, which they will be, which they will when they're enlightened. So therefore, the bodhisattva, at that time, do that before contemplating shunyata too much and contemplating selflessness and seeking like a separate nirvana too strongly. That's why that's sort of a phenomenological skill about the Buddhist path that's very, very important. So the next creativity is to, therefore psychological creativity, is to heighten one's altruism as much as possible.